This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 31st of December, 1956. The title of this lecture is Background on Scale of Havingness. This lecture is 45 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
All right. I told you this Congress that I would talk to you about dianazine, anti-radiation, and radiation. I did that, didn't I?
Yeah.
I told you I'd talk to you about insanity, causes and cures. I did that, didn't I?
Yeah.
Well, there's still one left. And that's the scale of havingness, the subject of awareness. Awareness is a very interesting subject. If you read Dianetics, Modern Science, and Mental Health, you'll find out that basically the whole thing depends upon awareness. Talks about the awareness of awareness unit, talks about awareness of this and awareness of that, and so forth. Doesn't define awareness. We've come along here for 6 years without a good definition for awareness. Now, a definition in Scientology must necessarily bring about a take-apart of what is being defined. Now, look, you can say that pillar is made out of matter. You said nothing. You've not said anything. What's matter? That definition doesn't permit you to make a pillar or take one apart. Instead of pillar, you've said matter. In other words, defining is usually done by substitution. And if you substitute enough words for enough words, then you've got enough confusion. Now, if you say awareness is lookingness, you haven't made any. You've just substituted word for word. Now, I'm afraid you won't get any place with this. You say people are aware of things when they look at things. Well, this is not actually a good definition because people are aware of things they're not looking at. So we get down to what awareness is. In order to solve the mind and solve the psyche, that's a Greek thing. That doesn't belong to psychologists. Psychologists is the one organization in the world that does not believe in the psyche. When you have awareness, what do you have? Well, you have ability. You have intelligence. You have alertness. All right, but where did it come from? Well, if you want intelligence and ability and alertness, if you want these things, you've got to have awareness. Okay, what is it? That's the problem. It reminds me of the stories, the folklore of the Blackfeet Indian. It's one of the more interesting folklores in America. They tell the story of the pack rat. And the pack rat, I've told this story before because I was always fascinated with this. An old medicine man told me this story when I was a little kid. I've laughed about it many a time. He told it with many dramatic gestures, which I won't. There was a little pack rat who was not yet a pack rat. And he was sitting on the edge of a stream. And he was feeling very good. He had the winter, which was to come, all figured out. And he had his food in. Everything was okay. Well, along came Old Man. Now, you must know that the Blackfeet Old Man is the person who built and made all the animals in the world. Every race has such a person. And he made all the animals, and he made all of their habits and everything. An old man came along and saw that pack rat sitting there, who was not yet a pack rat. And he says to him, what are you doing? And the rat said, nothing. Old man says, doing nothing, huh? So you got your winter stores in? And the rat said, sure. Old man says, you got any boojum? The rat says, Well, now it so happened that when old man got displeased with animals, he did interesting things to them. Like give them three tails or no tail. In fact, all the peculiarities of animals were tricks he has played on them. And so the rat, he says, eek, boojum. No, what is it? Old man said, you don't know what it is? It's boojum. The rat says, well, it's boojum. Well, old man says, the next time I come back, Mr. Rat, the next time I see you, if you don't have any boojum, ooh. And the rat went quiver. And from that day to this, Mr. Rat has been a pack rat. He has dragged in everything from any place and stored it. Just in the hopes that some of it will be boojum. Now, I'm afraid awareness is in the same category. Everybody tells you got to be bright, you got to be alert, you got to be this, you got to be that, you've got to be aware, you've got to be smart, you've got to be so-and-so. And all of these are unattainable quantities. They are so unattainable in past history that it is in every mental book, books which pretended to concern themselves with the mind as taught in universities, that there is no changing intelligence. One cannot change the personality of a person. That personality is what it is, and as he grows in years, his personality changes to agree with the years, but nothing else. It's not possible to change anything. Now, Scientologists blows this up higher than a kite. We've got file drawers and file cases so full of changes measured on the very best accepted tests that we have blown this up sky high. But Scientology does it, nothing else does. Nevertheless, the world believed you couldn't even change intelligence. You couldn't change an attitude. You couldn't change a personality in any way. You couldn't change an ability. But you had to have it. You had to be able. You were hired and fired. In other words, permitted to eat or not permitted to eat as your intelligence and ability were found adequate or wanting. In other words, a man could be sentenced to death in this society for not having some boojum. He doesn't know what it is. There are a bunch of fellows around that pretend to measure it. But nobody knows what it is. What is intelligence? Well, a very, very smart professor who was a wildcat radical squirrel in the psychology field finally said, defined intelligence. He says, intelligence is what the tests measure. I think that's the best definition I ever heard of it. That's what the tests measure. I think that's terrific, isn't it? Scientologist told me that one day. I was very edified. That's the best definition they ever had for it. And yet, if you haven't got it, you're sunk. Now, we know it differs from person to person, and we know we can change it, but what is it? Bujum. If you haven't got some, Lord knows what will happen to you. Now, what's ability? Well, ability is easily measurable. Somebody goes out and sits down in an airplane and he flies it. That's fine. He is able to fly an airplane. Somebody else goes down and sits in an airplane and, that's him buttered all over the end of the runway. What's the difference? What's the difference? One is able to fly the airplane and one is not able to fly the airplane. Well, that's an observable fact, isn't it? So we can take that one for granted. Some people can and some can't. But what is this thing that varies in this fashion? What is this thing that varies in this fashion? Why? We say, well, one person hasn't been taught how to fly an airplane, and the other person has been. Oh, no. Take two guys, put them under the same instructors, give them the same ease of handling, utilize the same care, and one is able to fly, able to learn, able to grasp and coordinate and fly airplanes. And the other one gets buttered up all over the end of the runway. What is this thing? The second you take it away from an observable fact and put it back into the never-never land of what is it, we get all sorts of odd superstitions in the society. We say some people can paint and some can't. Some people are good at mathematics and some people aren't. People who are good at the arts are not good at mathematics. Oh, yeah? I've heard that said. I've also heard it said that people who are good at the arts are usually good at mathematics. We get the superstitions, then, of skills. We get the idea of talent. This man has great talent. That's another boojum. Parents get little Roscoe. They put little Roscoe down on the piano stool. And they say, Roscoe, play. Roscoe sits there, and 5 years later, he's still hashing it. And they say, well, Roscoe just doesn't have talent. That's what the teacher says finally. But they put little Mary down on the piano stool, and they say to little Mary, play. And she plays Tchaikovsky's Concerto in G flat. Right off, you know, bang. They say, she's got lots of talent. What is this thing? It's bujum. Now, one person can play and one can't. One person's mathematically inclined and one isn't. One person can fly an airplane and one can't. Well, now, we could explain this Dianetically, by saying individuals have had unhappy experiences doing certain things back on the track. And when they get into this life, they find out they can't. Now, this is a good explanation, and as a matter of fact, has a basis in fact. Skills, when learned well in one lifetime, very often, because one has lost that life, become lost in the next one. This isn't the matter, however, of ability. This is the matter of experience, engrams, re-stimulation, any number of things. Any number of factors which depress one's willingness to do. Willingness to do. Willingness to be. And we in Dianetics and Scientology have long understood that a person's willingness to do or be could be altered by his experience. Experience alters his willingness to do or be, and that that experience is traceable back through a considerable passage of time. But we know something else. We know that the Thetan, without all of this hard-learned experience, can learn to do anything. Well, it looks like we've sort of wound up in just a more complicated bujum. But we haven't, because that factor today we can change with considerable ease. Considerable ease. It has to do with the scale of havingness. And two nights ago, you were doing your first exercises in the Congress on confrontingness. Remember? Remember when I audited you on confrontingness? All right. Confrontingness is awareness. One can be aware. This is the $8,762 question answered. One can be aware only of that which they are in some way willing to confront. Some willingness to confront is necessary for the phenomenon known as awareness. One can be aware of those things which he is willing in some way to confront. One, if he is willing, even to some slight degree, willing to confront something, he can become aware of it. But if he cannot confront it and will not confront it and has an idea that he must not confront it, it after a while disappears entirely from view. And he is no longer able to be aware of it. And in that is contained IQ, ability, talent, and all other such factors. Now you say, person walks up the aisle here and runs into this Black Panther. He says, "Yow!" and gets out. But remember, he saw it and he knew it was a Black Panther. He knew this was a Black Panther. All right, if he knew it was a Black Panther, if he could see it at all, he was willing to confront it. Do you understand me? Even though it scared him stiff, there was still a willingness to confront it to some degree. Otherwise, he couldn't even see it. He would see no Black Panther at all. Now that is the secret back of the fellow who can and the fellow who can't fly the airplane. The fellow who takes one off smoothly and the fellow who butters one all over the end of the runway. The little boy who sits down to the piano and cannot play after 5 years, and the little girl who sits down and starts playing easily at once. What's the difference? The little boy was unwilling to confront the music, and the little girl was perfectly willing to. That's the difference. That's all the difference there is. There's no further difference. I'm sorry if it reduces to a simplicity of this character. I realize it robs you of a game. I realize definitely that it completely spoils a lot of excuses. Very interesting how handy excuses are in living. They do play a part of living. They're very handy. For instance, every once in a while we run into our parents saying, I can't afford this and I can't afford that, and I can't give you this and I can't give you that, when we were little kids, you know. The old man would say, well, I just can't afford that. You're just costing me a fortune and so forth. You're always after me for some money, something like this. Of course, the obvious answer that I thought of years too late was, what's the matter with you that you don't get out and make more money? The obvious thing to tell a parent. What's the matter with you that you're only making that much money? It's completely an overwhelming statement, isn't it? Yeah, what is the matter with him? More money's needed in the family. Why isn't he making more? Simple. Direct. What's that? That'd really take these guys aback. Well, they aren't making money maybe because they're unwilling to confront it. They're not very aware of it. Maybe they make as much money as they're aware of, or can be aware of, or is willing to be aware of. They conceive something terrible in having to be aware of $1 billion. There's something very reprehensible in being aware of that much money. And you start testing people's havingness on money. Most of the pre-clears you pull in off the street actually couldn't have more than 2 or 3 cents. That's right, that's the amount of money that they could be aware of. The amount of money that they could confront. What's dangerous about money? Well, let me tell you, on the whole track, there's been lots of things dangerous about money. You had a faithful slave whose acceptance level in money was 1,000 kropotniks. And somebody slipped him 1,000, and he slipped you the arsenic. In other words, money is something that can overturn loyalty. Money is something that corrodes the spirit. Money is something you drive people out of temples about. Money is this, money is that. Money's bad, it's all bad over there. It's gotten so bad to the Republican administration that they're afraid to issue any. They've completely overlooked something awfully interesting about money. They've overlooked this utterly. They are so immersed in the ideas of business, or so immersed in the ideas of militarism, that they have overlooked entirely the primary function of a national government, which is the creation of money. A businessman obtains his money in the marts of trade. He takes it away from private individuals. A military man takes it away from businessmen or private individuals at the point of a gun. See, he says, broom, contribute. That is the time-honored method of doing this. When you get too much business and too much military mixed up in the government, both of them overlook the fact that the primary principle of government requires that money be created in an adequate supply to buy the goods which are in existence in the country. That's what a government's supposed to do. That's part of its service. It even says it in the Constitution, Congress is supposed to coin money. By the way, one of the primary causes of the American Revolution, by the way, very interesting, Ben Franklin had a big hand in this. The crown across the vast distance of the Atlantic, which we now fly in 10 minutes. I think they're getting their flying time down to about that. They allow enough time to make a smooth approach in the flight. They will always have to do that. They will always have to keep a smooth approach time in there until somebody invents an automatic receding airfield. Now, England wouldn't send enough money over to the colonies. There weren't enough pounds, shillings, and pence. And it was so bad that no trade could occur in Pennsylvania. And you know Pennsylvanians. Well, that was the end of the English government in the States. That happened decades before the American Revolution. But the point here is that money was scarce. Well, somewhere along the line, somebody was unwilling to confront some and wouldn't create any. Now, that happened maybe in England. Might have happened amongst the traders that were working with Pennsylvania from England. Might have happened almost any place, but a scarcity occurred, and sooner or later, King George III went mad, and the only thing, by the way, maybe you don't know this, but the truth of the matter is that King George III went mad because of the American Revolution. That's right, he went stark, staring crazy. He used to wander around in the lonely, damp halls of the palace after the American Revolution was over, saying, "Where are my American colonies?" Americans don't know that, usually. He went mad as a hatter. The situation there was that sufficient finance would not be provided. Somebody refused to confront the problem connected with money. Somebody refused to confront money itself and brought about a scarcity of it. Now look how simply we can state this. We say, somebody didn't want to confront money, so he didn't make any. He didn't want to confront money, so he wouldn't let any go into circulation. One of the ways of not confronting money is to put it all in your back pockets. Build up an $8 million bank account. Never look at a penny of it. Get all the money out of circulation in this fashion. And that, to a large extent, is a motive on the part of some capitalists. Not to have money, not to buy money, but to get money out of circulation so people won't have to confront it. You think I'm joking now? That you won't after you've run some pre-clears on this. Papa, when he wasn't making enough money, couldn't confront it. So he wasn't even aware of the fact he was broke. He thought he was doing all right. See, he was getting along there on his $3 a week or whatever they used to pay. He thought he was doing all right. That was what a man in his profession ought to be making, he thought, maybe. He wasn't even aware of the fact that he was short of the stuff. Now, that's a fantastic thing. And that's how bad confronting of money can become. There's many an auditor who is a fine auditor who simply has the bug of being unable to confront money. So he goes around and he audits people for free all the time, and he audits them for free, and he audits them for free, and then one fine day he finds out that his auditing can't support his livingness, and he stops auditing people because he has to make some money. So he interrupts his whole career and goes and does something silly. Get the idea? I mean, he just can't confront the idea of that. He says, "I can't ask people for it." Well, now let's break this down. You mean he can't look at it? You got that? I mean, it just breaks down, just bing, bing, just like that. I can't ask people for something. It just breaks down to the fact, not that it isn't even as complicated as I cannot confront the situation of somebody sitting there and handing me some money, you see? It's not even that complicated. It's just the fact that, what is the object? Money. What is he doing? He's not confronting it. And that is that. He's not confronting money. He's unwilling to. After a while, he becomes unaware of the stuff. It no longer exists. A whole society could get into this frame of mind. This is rather one of the funnier jokes that could happen to governments, and which has happened. You know, there was a fella one time made all the money in the area. He was the first communist, by the way. Over in the Mediterranean area. He was first communist. It's from that point that communism gets the totality of its activity. Sparta. That's the world's first well-documented, well-dreamed-up communism. And the Russians have taken that lock, stock, and barrel. That is the Spartan philosophy. One fellow, I think it was Lycurgus, came in there and dreamed everything up. I don't know who that was. He was the fellow who started it, but he was quite a boy. And he became so unaware of money that nobody could have any, so he had to make money out of iron. See, he had great big millstone-like things made out of solid iron that nobody could carry around. And he said he was going to cure everybody of love of money. This was what he thought was the trouble. Well, what was the trouble with him? He couldn't confront the stuff. So he made it unconfrontable. Nobody'd ever be able to wheel in one of these cartwheels on him. They actually were the size of ox cart wheels. And that was his money. Of course, it went out of circulation, and that was that, and the communism was inevitable. Communism takes place when people go downhill to a point where they can no longer confront money or the commodities of trade, and they make nothing out of both. They can no longer confront either. You never find a communism manufacturing very much. No, a lot of people up at the top of things become unable to confront commodity, become unable to confront money, make nothing out of both. When you start making nothing out of money, you start making nothing out of commodity, that's for sure. Got that? And once one ceases to be willing to confront something, that something becomes a nothing. To him, it's a very peculiar thing. He's liable to become so unaware of people, he looks straight through them. He runs into them in the street. You ever run into anybody who ran into everybody? He was just unaware. We'd say he was clumsy, he was this, he was that. No, he was unwilling to confront people to the degree that he didn't see them at all. They had ceased to exist. And there was where his awareness went. Now we take this fellow who buttered himself over the end of the runway, and we tried to teach him an airplane. Do you know that if somebody had taken him up and said, "What is that in front of you?" And the fellow would have said, "Well, that's a... don't tell me. It's some concrete." Somebody would have said, "What? That airplane is built out of concrete?" And the fellow would have said, "Airplane? Yeah, that airplane that's sitting right there. Now, what is it?" He would have said, "Well, it's an airplane. Anybody know that?" He's just repeating what the other guy said. He probably couldn't even see it. Here's this interesting thing. It's all blurred out as far as he's concerned, you see. It's fogged up in some fashion. It has features that he never observes. You know, such as stick, aileron, rudder. Now you're going to teach him to fly something he doesn't know is there. And he winds up buttering himself all over the end of the runway. Little Roscoe sitting down there at the piano. He's going to play what? What's in front of him? Oh, he'd say, "Anybody knows what's in front of me? Nothing." We take the differences of sound pitches, differences of sound. Some people are aware of them, some people aren't. Differences of pitch. Ah, but this breaks down to a much grosser problem of awareness of sound. Is somebody willing to confront sound? If he's willing to confront it, he will be very, very good at differentiating it. If he's not willing to confront it, it will be an utter silence. And if he's only indifferently willing to confront it, he will simply be annoyed about it. And we get the tone scale intervening between total willingness to have total awareness and the bottom of the scale, it isn't. And the responses to any given thing between those two points we call the emotional response, or lack of it. Now this, in essence, is the tone scale. It is a willingness to confront. Now, confront is an interesting thing because it's only part of a scale, which we have been calling the havingness scale. We still call it the havingness scale so that it will communicate to you. But it's actually not a havingness scale. It is an awareness scale or a confrontingness scale. Do you see this? Now, that is the basic. That is the basic behind intelligence, behind ability, behind skill, talent, so on. It's willingness to confront. That's all. Even if something scares somebody green, he must have some willingness to confront it, to have seen it, to be scared by it. You get the idea. Now, the people who walk around in the society and they're not aware of this and they're not aware of that are no longer willing to confront these things. They are no longer willing to confront these things. They're no longer willing to confront politics or politicians or police or anything else. And do you know they get so bad off that after a while the whole government disappears to them? Police disappear to them. I know a whole nation where the police have disappeared to its populace. It's a very orderly nation because they're very good people. But they've had so many police and the police have been so poor that the populace now no longer considers police police. They just hope that police aren't. They don't bother to obey the law anymore. They don't bother to have any response to police. Police have to be very, very assertive in order to get anybody's attention at all. They've actually had to completely form a brigade throughout the country of traffic police, entirely differently uniformed, differently labeled and everything else, to get automobiles to stop when they raise their hands. I'm not exaggerating this. This is Spain. They just, there isn't any sense in obeying the law anymore. I mean, we just go along just the way we've been going along for years, and we treat each other nice if we can, and there's no telling what law is going to be passed anyways, the way they explain it. But they are not in a state of awareness. They are no longer willing to be aware of the police forces of the country, or the military forces. This is amazing. I asked a fellow just a few months ago in Spain, I said, are they still barracking Moors there at the fort? And just pointed down the street. And the fellow said to me, you won't believe this. He said, the fort isn't occupied. And I said, what do you mean isn't occupied? The guards walking up and down and so forth. And now he says the fort, it was up on the hill, it was one of the old guardian forts of the port, and it was no longer occupied. The Fortaleza, he corrected me, and I said, no, the base, the garrison. I said, are there Moors still being garrisoned in the town? The garrison, the fort, the barracks, the army headquarters, right there. He looked over in that direction and the conversation ceased. And I didn't understand the phenomenon at that time. And I thought, boy, this guy is vague. He wasn't afraid. But every day, within a block and a half of that man, soldiers were marching up and down and saluting and bugles were going and guns firing and everything happening right in the middle of the town. And this fellow's business was within sight of all this, and he never saw a single bit of it. This fellow had been sufficiently chewed up in the Spanish Revolution that he no longer cared to be aware and would not confront any of that. And he'd evidently probably made a postulate that he would go right on living in Spain and just forget about the whole thing. In other words, forget about the whole thing, no longer confront any part of the whole thing. At that moment, it would cease to exist. Now, we know positively that if we confront a driver with an automobile and confront an automobile with a driver And we get them just to touch things, touch things, touch things, touch things, touch things. Just 8C, we make a better driver. We can take people who cannot pass a driving test. We don't teach them anything about driving particularly. We just make them go up and touch the steering wheel, touch the hubcaps, touch the back of the car, the front of the car. In other words, we run 8C on them. We make them touch that car and touch that car and touch that car and make and break communication, make and break communication, on and on and on and on. And then if we wanted to go a little bit further ahead, we'd make them drive the car a little bit. But the driving of the car is unimportant. That's what has always mystified me in these particular tests. Because I've made several of these tests, and I've discovered that individuals did not particularly respond to driving training so much as contact with the vehicle. And I found out that was the big jump. When they make contact with the vehicle, and you ran them a long time on that, they get along fine. But if you spend a lot of time teaching them driving, start, change, and stop of the vehicle, you didn't advance as far. In your training program, you didn't advance as far as just making them touch the car. Well, what was this all about? Well, it's summed up in this business of confrontingness. You showed them that it was possible for them to confront that car. You showed them that confrontability was a possibility. You showed them that there was something there, and when they became aware of it, they became aware of it so sweepingly that they were, of course, able to control it. They were made aware of it by confronting it. And that is the answer which lies back of these various things we call intelligence and other things. Now, willing to have is a lower scale phenomenon of confront. Waste, substitute. These are all lower-scale phenomena. Create is an upper-scale phenomena. But a person will not create those things which he is unwilling to confront. Now, there are some other aspects to this that have to do with quantity and exactly how things disappear and exactly what the scale is. But in essence, it sums up to this. That people who are unwilling to confront things are not aware of them. And their awareness is monitored entirely by their willingness to confront. Their intelligence is their willingness to confront, because what is intelligence but awareness? And what is awareness but willingness to confront? And so, because we have been following through rather interestedly, and because every time we found something in Scientology which worked, we carefully saved it and kept on using it, we eventually moved in to this particular sphere and found out that it was not contactingness, but confrontingness. There are many phenomena which prove this particular theory. There are many phenomena, patterns which operate and demonstrate this whole tenet of confrontingness. But amongst the best demonstrations is simply making a person look around and find something he's willing to communicate with, or look around and touch things. The room brightens up. His vision changes. Other things occur. Well, of course his vision changes because he's willing to be aware of things, so naturally he can see them. Now, actually, it isn't meanness on the part of individuals. It isn't just plain cussedness. It isn't orneriness that makes him unwilling to confront. There is another mechanism that backs in behind this awareness mechanism, which is quite fascinating, since it is just the idea of willingness, but that idea can disintegrate. And I'll tell you about that in the next hour. Thank you.